Thanks, Jesse, for inviting us. So this is joint work with Laurent and Eli. It's about term structure models. There are many term structure models already in the literature, so why we need it more? So so if you want to model term structure of interest rates from 1 week maturity to say 30 or 40 years, you really need to accommodate shock from a whole spectrum of kind of frequencies, right? At the long term, low frequency economists talk about inflation and real GDP growth and how they affect the term structure. Right? That's a kind of a hot topic right now on macro finance literature. Right? At intermediate horizon, central bankers try to implement their monetary policy by controlling the short end of the yield curve, and through that control, they try to affect actually the whole term structure, right? By altering people's expectation about future short rate movements. And at ultra high frequency, very short term, then you have market microstructure researchers who kind of ignore all these macro movements, but focus squarely on a segment and focus on the supply demand kind of shock, right? Suppose there's a large order on a 5-year swap contract, the swap rate will be moved accordingly. And the broker dealers, they give you that contract, that they're trying to hedge with nearby contracts, so the shock will dissipate gradually across maturities, right? And the hedge funds can also accommodate this kind of liquidity by doing butterfly trades. And through this kind of trades, the shock will dissipate, right? So a successful model, you should, on term structure, you should try to capture the effects of all these kind of different frequencies. Theory is there, right? We have effect a fun quadratic models in theory of n dimensions. N can be as large as you want. But in practice, we are pretty much limited or constrained to low dimensional models because of dimensionality, right? A generic three-factor affine model, let's say, has about 20 to 30 parameters. So imagine you increase the dimension to, say, 8, right? The dimension increase, like parameter increase quadratically more or less because you have all these matrix. Okay? It's not doable that way. But here, we're trying to propose a classical model that can include as many frequencies as you want, as many dimensions as you want, but with no cross of dimensionality. Actually, the model are dimension invariant. That is, we have the same number of parameters no matter how many factors you add. The model we really estimate only have 5 parameters. Okay. How do we do that? There are 2 layers we're trying to do. First, the generic affine model, quadratic model, the hidden kind of factor model has the issue of factor rotation. Right? You specify a 3-factor model, then close your eyes, do the estimation. You don't really know where the factor will go. Then afterwards, you say, oh, the first factor looks like a short term or long term, right? Wherever it goes. Right? So first, we try to remove that factor rotation by pinning down the frequencies of the factors or the distribution of the factors through what we call a cascading structure. Okay. We start at the highest frequency, that's the highest identifiable frequency, and then write a kind of mean reversion process, say AR1, right? We let it to mean revert to a lower frequency, that's slower kind of movement. And then sequentially, you let the next N-1 movement factor to mean reverse to another one, even lower kind of frequency component, right? So this kind of cascading structure can keep going, right, to as far as you want. And we ended somewhere saying that, okay, enough. So we set it to 0 here and set it to a long run mean, right? Intuitively, you can think of it as a kind of like exponential moving average stuff, right? You draw the original price, depends on your observation frequency, say daily. And then you said, I want to know the trend. Then you do a 30-day moving average, 6-day moving average, and so on. Right? So get for the layers, depending on how long your data is, you can do many kind of layers of moving average. And intuitively, I mean, n can go to infinity. You can keep going if you have long enough data, essentially. Or you can go the other direction. If you sample your data super frequently, you can make n very big, going to the other direction, right? You can add lots of higher frequencies, or you can add lots of lower and lower frequencies. Right? So you can go on 2 dimensions. And if you compare that with the generic kind of affine model, say, if I write a Van Gaussian model, right, this is how you write it, you specify a set of factors, and then you set a short rate is a linear function of them, so these everything's kind of free. But you can easily rotate these models, right, without affecting anything. For example, I just write down one rotation, which you can get rid of the mean in the factors, and also normalize the covariance matrix to an identity matrix without losing anything, because these things are just kind of rotating the factors, right? For example, Diane Singleton's this JF paper, they spend the whole paper really about how do you rotate these models, how do you classify them, so get rid of all these factors, parameters that you cannot identify, right? Even after that, you find in different specifications, you have parameters you cannot identify, okay? But here, what we essentially did is to rank all the factors according to their frequency. We put the highest frequency here, and then just sequentially put the factors there, right? So there's no rotation anymore in terms of factors. And also, the factors have very much intuitive meaning, right? 1 over the mean reversion speed, the kappa j parameter, it essentially has a unit of time. So intuitively, you know what you're trying to capture. Say, if I want to capture my highest frequency is daily, then I set kappa, the highest frequency of kappa to 252, say, right, 300 days a year. So 1 over that would be my frequency, right? So if I have 30 years of data, I set my lowest kappa to 1 over 30 or 1 over 10 or 1 over 7. You think 10 years of data, how many cycles, you know, for 10 years? Probably like cut it in half, right? So if I have, you know, 100 years, then you said, okay, the lowest frequency I can go is 1 over 50. So you essentially know what this parameter can be. And how many intermediate numbers you add just depends on how many intermediate things you want to capture. There's some time series. And from cross-section, it's very easy to think too, right? If I want to capture a term structure from 1 week to 30-year maturity, that's the kappa range, right? And what's the distribution? Depends on how many materials of instruments I add in the middle, right? So before you do estimation, your parameter is essentially set, right? But still, there are lots of like moving parts here. With J's, right? As you increase dimensions, these things will increase. So how do I make it dimension invariant? The general idea is that since the factors are ranked across frequencies, so you just need to approximate the distribution of these parameters across different frequencies using a functional form, right? And we start with kappa. Kappa has to be different from different frequencies by nature. It's a frequency measure. So here we assume that the distribution of these different frequencies follow a power law. That is, they scale by kind of by a power b. When I set it b to 2, then it doubles every time, right? You can think of it as 1 month, 2 months, 4 months, something like that, right? It's just getting larger and larger. It usually makes sense, right? When you look at these measurements, they don't give you interest rates at 1, 2, 3, 4 months uniformly distributed maturity. Instead, it's 1, 2, 3, 6, 9, 12. After that, it's 2 year, then goes to 5 year, goes to 10 year, then 30 years, right? So it's getting larger and larger, right? So the power scaling kind of give you that distribution. And this is nothing new. In Ethermetrics, we have been using this functional form to approximate a distribution of all the coefficients, right, to reduce number of parameters. For example, this geometrically distributed lattice model, right, allows you to add as many lattices as you want, but the lattice coefficient is dampened according to a kind of a power coefficient, right? So that's just a way of adding as much information as you want, but don't give you too many parameters to estimate, right, to increase the stability of the model, okay? And we also need to make assumptions on volatility and the risk premium, but since our focus is just trying to get a term structure model without going into the options, so the volatility is not that much of a deal for us. It doesn't affect the term structure much, so we just set it to a constant number, one number, right? And risk premium also. Remember, the AFI model are really specified on the risk neutral dynamics. It says nothing about risk premium. So here, we just stick to one number, right? So, and after these assumptions, you only have five parameters, and regardless of how many factors you have, right? Because everything is kind of set based on these five parameters. But if you say, no, I want to price options, let's separate. These two things are pretty much orthogonal. Try to do them together, actually just mess you up, okay? You estimate the term structure model for focus on the term structure variation. If you want to model volatilities, just, it's kind of separate estimation. Take the yield curve as given, fit it well, and then just focus on the modeling of volatility. And for that, you can do a cascading structure. You can make them dimension invariant as well. But it's just a second step, right? you said, I want to do risk premium analysis. It's a huge literature on expectation hypothesis, bound risk premium, this kind of analysis. That you can also do in the second step. After you extract all these different frequencies as your factor, then you want to analyze how different frequencies affect your bound risk premium at different horizons, right? You cannot just look at a 1 year investment horizon, right? Different horizon actually will be affected by different frequency components. That's to give you a starting point to analyze. And actually the simplest way to analyze them is through bound return regression, not by fitting the term structure, okay? And through these, you can use the anti-identified interest rate factor, identified volatility factor from the interest rate cap, you know, volatility cube. Then you analyze which of these factors affect the excess bound return. Right? You said, no, there are too many factors, so the correlation, you would have a lot of correlation. So again, you can make functional formal assumptions on the correlation. For example, Cochrane and Piazzetti had this bound risk premium paper saying that somehow a tent-shaped combination of four rate forecast excess return over a year, then you know, can you formulate that functional form on B as a kind of hump-shaped structure, right? And how do you sort of shift that hump-shaped term structure based on your different forecasting horizon? Suppose you want to look at 1 month instead of 1 year horizon, how that thing will change, right? And whether vol affects it or not, in what functional form. So these are all kind of, you can do the analysis afterwards. But for us, we just focus on the term structure. And under our simple assumption, the bond pricing is exponentially fine. You get this fall rate is fine. The intercept has three components. You have a kind of long-run mean component, risk premium. Without this component, the term structure is downward sloping. You add a risk premium, the mean term structure goes upward sloping. And the last term is convexity adjustment due to the volatility. So this is just the aggregate term. Its effect is really small. That's why we just put a constant number there. It doesn't really affect that much. And these are the factor loading, instantaneous response of the four rate to these different factors. You can see this is the high frequency component. It affects the short rate and the extended job. But for all the other frequencies, it all has this kind of hump-shaped kind of form, right? You can think of these really as kind of fixed basis functions. Then the factors are like a time-varying weight, right? You're essentially using these as the base function, times the weight to capture whatever term structure is going, right? The weight is changing, give you different shapes of term structure, right? And so we said, okay, the model looks very simple. Let's do some estimation. So we picked out some LIBOR swap rates. How many of them? 15 of them over about 10 years, is that right? Yeah, more than 10 years. So 678 of the weeks. About 10,000 data points, and I estimate this model using kind of a state space method, cast these factors into a Hayden state, and regard these 15 rates as observables with error, and using a common filter to infer the space, and using maximum likelihood to estimate the parameters. Okay, so here I only have 5 parameters. If I estimate a 20 parameter three factor model, AFI model, it's very fast, couple of hours I can get it done in a laptop. These just 5 parameters, you think of like F mean search kind of searching thing, right? The dimension is so small, it's very fast. 20 minutes maybe or less, you can get it converged. And also, since the meaning of these parameters are so tightly related, right? So you can really specify these numbers very close to its true number. The convergence is very fast. And I didn't mention dimension yet, right? Normally when you specify a model, you have to say how many factors you use before you can write down the parameter space. Now actually, I only have that 5 parameters, no matter how many factors I add. So this is the least thing I'm concerned about. I put it in the left, right? And since I have 15 times risk, I said, let me just abuse it, just estimate models with 1 factor, 2 factor, until 15 factors. Remember, each model estimation takes about 10, 15 minutes. So finishing all of them doesn't take me much time at all, right? And I hope that through this kind of extensive exercise, I can learn exactly based on the data I have, how many frequency components I need, and whether these high dimensional models differ from the traditional low dimensional models that we estimate, say a three factor model. So these are the parameter estimates, and in the end I did a kind of a likelihood, one likelihood kind of test, assuming the non-nested model. So they're all against the 15 factor model. roughly this is a kind of a key statistic. You can say they're all significant, which means that the 50-factor model is better than all the other models statistically. And you can look at the parameters, right? They're kind of stabilizing, except that B is getting smaller and smaller. B, remember, B controls the distribution of the frequencies. If you have one factor, you put it in the middle. If you have two, you put it in the two ends. Three, put the other way in the middle, right? So as you add more, they're just getting closer to each other. B is getting smaller. So B controls the grade of the frequency component. So it's kind of natural. So we'll assume power law, so I also estimate model where I don't assume anything on kappa at three parameters. So the red dots are estimated at three. The blue line is my kind of power law assumption. So it's kind of roughly getting there, right? And also once you have them all three, the model doesn't take forever to really go to a point. It doesn't really converge as fast anymore. With a five parameter model, you can start anywhere. It goes right to the place you start. And the performance, lots of numbers, but I'm comparing it like three-factor with a 15-factor model. I guess the ballpark number is the root mean squared error, about 6 bits for the three-factor model, less than a bit for a 15-factor model. It's 6 bits, nothing. Well, it depends on which market you're talking about, right? For economists, you don't really care. You're thinking about the rate of 1% to, you know, 5, 10%. But for the swap market, the basis, the bid ask is about half a bit to one bit, right? 6 bit is quite significant. You can really trade on those. But in our kind of in the high dimensional model, 15-factor model, these are really kind of close to zero. Right? The R squares are all close to 100%. So in essence, I guess you can use the model really as a splitting method. Right? I know in the academic literature we use Nelson-Siegel, but for the swap curve, nobody in the industry uses Nelson-Siegel because it doesn't fit. Exactly, right? And the most kind of common practice in the industry is piecewise constant forward. It's not good. They know there are issues because it's kinky points, but it fits everything. And it has another version, it's sequential. It's very stable, and it starts in short term. And you can think of like our version as a kind of smooth version of that, right? And we're not quite getting there in terms of sequential. We're still kind of a global. But the basis function, remember, it's like a local hump shaped, right? So give us some stability in terms of fitting. Nelson-Siegel, you can think of it as a three-factor version of ours, right? Because it's also kind of a Gaussian kind of case if you try to kind of convert it into a factor model. And then I did some forecasting exercise. So I tried AR1, three-factor and 15-factor, and these are just the R-square. R-square, zero means a random walk. Okay, negative means it's worse than a random walk, basically. So AR1, these are in-sample by design, is better than random walk, right? You run a fitted regression, the error will be smaller than itself. Three-factor model is not good. That's a kind of common finding, right? It goes back to Gregory Duffy and quite a few people, Richard Stanton, they find that these three-factor models, whether it's a 5-parameter, 20, 30-parameter, it doesn't really matter. The forecasting performance tends to be worse than a random walk. Right, so I find the same thing. But the 15-factor model does do better in sample. Let's look at our sample. But our sample AR1 completely breaks down. Remember, these are highly persistent series, right? All the correlation is about 0.99 in a daily kind of series. So AR1 has the problem of overfitting. Then 15-factor model basically stays the same in sample, out of sample, because you have so few parameters. Okay, so that's the one page. So why AR1 is bad? Because it doesn't use term structure information. It's a univariate analysis. And it's not parsimonious either, because for each series, I have two parameters, an intercept and autocorrelation. So 15 series, I have 30 parameters, right? So AR1 would be better because it uses all the term structure information, but it's just too wild in terms of number of parameters, right? So you can think of our model as very parsimonious, 5 parameters, but does use cross-section information, right? The three-factor model also is parsimonious and use cross-section information, except that it doesn't fit well. Well, if it doesn't fit, you cannot use it, right? Because if you have a 6-bit fitting error, your next instant prediction will carry that error with you, right? So it's not going to work. But our model, since it fits perfectly, so it kind of overcome that problem. Okay? So that's A. So we propose this kind of classical model. We use a cascade factor structure to eliminate factor rotation. and then achieve dimension invariance by using functional form, right, to describe the distribution across different frequencies. And we find that, you know, this model estimation shows that there is kind of some advantages because we can estimate as high a dimension as we want without perfect dimensionality. And also there are several dimensions in which we find that high dimension models do perform better. This kind of logic, you can use it easily, apply it easily to option pricing on the law dynamics and for risk premium analysis, except that you need to do this really separately to really nail down the